Hello, this is a recording of the Story Cafe Perspectives on Citizen Science from Ecuador, Ghana and Small Island Developing States. My name is Claudia Göbel and I was happy to organize that session at the International Citizen Science Conference in Geneva on 3rd June 2018. The idea of the Story Cafe was to come together on a Sunday afternoon, the day just before the official conference program started, and to take some time to listen to perspectives that are not very often present in the discussions on citizen science in Europe. I was very fortunate to get three amazing speakers to come and share their experiences with us on that day. The first one was Thomas Mboa. He works on open and participatory research, DIY biology and cognitive justice with the Association for the Promotion of Open Science in Haiti and Africa. He shared a story on the importance of social cultural values in citizen science. The second storyteller was Kalisa Iklef from UNESCO. There, she looks after the Sandwatch project for beach monitoring in small island and developing states and coastal countries. That includes the UNESCO Associated School Network. And our third speaker was Soledad Luna, who is pushing citizen science activities for research and conservation in Ecuador. She shared a story on how small-scale fishermen created and monitored a temporal no-take zone to allow for the recovery of the marine resources that the fishermen depend upon. We will hear all three stories that were recorded during the conference and a short discussion with the speakers. So let me invite you to imagine an old community hall in the center of Geneva, the Salle Communale de Plan Palais, where the conference took place. You enter the ballroom, and on any other Sunday you would find a conference or a performance here. Now we have the story cafe, so please find a chair in one of our three circles. Thomas is already about to start.
We are trained to solve our local problem with Western eyes. And this brings to a kind of cognitive conflicts, a kind of epistemic alienation. So how can I describe a local plan with Western eyes? It's very difficult to explain. And one of the idea was Africans and Haitians can take advantage offered by open science, advantage offered by openness to try to hack this way to do or this way to think, to try to overcome this epistemic alienation. So we start to give them tools and weapons to empower themselves. And this work rise to the organization of this big summit that we have in Accra, the Open Science and Hardware Summit, where like many countries, many people involved in open science reach to the event. And we did a very big session about the brainstorming about what is open science, what is citizen science, how can we describe or how can we define this concept, considering our local view, our local eyes. And it appeared very clearly that the notion of citizen is not universal. So the citizen, as you consider citizen in Germany, in Switzerland, or in Paris, or everywhere in the Western country, is not the same like in my country, in Cameroon, is not the same in Accra. And particularly when you talk to people about citizen science, when people hear about civil society organization in Cameroon, is very problematic, for example. Because if you talk about civil society, you will be made like you are fighting the executive power in place, like you are opposing. Civil society is very in the imaginary of our political leaders is very related to, is very political, you know, is very, it look like you want to fight the system in place. So when you tell to people that you are able to do something like this, many people tell you, no, I don't want to have any problem with the government because you are bringing me to this direction of citizen science or something like that. So on this way, how can we talk about citizen science in our context? That was one of the very big discussion in Kumasi in Ghana. Another experience we had after the summit is during the AfroPixel in Dakar, where we discussed about open science. You know, some values shared by open science and citizen science are this value of collaboration, horizontal collaboration, this value of sharing knowledge without limit, this value of equity, inclusiveness, or something like that. But during our panel in Dakar, I was in the panel with a pupil working in with leather. Lequi, in front, leader, yes, leader worker. And there was native from Senegal. And in Senegal, there is like a family of leader worker. So like a caste of leader worker. And the other, in the other side, I had like a leather worker, but coming from France, and she, the woman went in Senegal to establish his small maker space there to work on leather, and she wanted to collaborate with local families of leather worker, but they deny, the local Senegalese worker denied to collaborate with them because, firstly, she's a woman. Secondly, she is not belonging of this traditional caste of working leader, worker of leader in Senegal. And it appeared like they didn't see this relation like to a collaboration, horizontal collaboration, but like people want to stall their knowledge, their traditional knowledge, how they work on leader, on how their techniques, their local techniques. So, but in my way as African and working open science, it was also a big issue because should I take it like what they are doing is not open science because they don't want to collaborate and they want to keep their knowledge inside the caste. And in the other side, the woman who wants to work with them, I'm not sure about her real intention, you know, because now people in open science are using open science to capture local innovation and to try to make other things behind this kind of thing. So that is the two stories that I want to share with you in order to discuss and to see how, or to show you how sociocultural value are very important in citizen science. And sometimes it can appear, since our social cultural values are so different around the world, it can appear that, no, you are not doing citizen science or open science, or your idea about citizen science or how you want to implement it, or you want to help Africa, people in Africa to do project in citizen science doesn't fit with your imaginary. So you can have this kind of conflicts. And for me, the most important is before trying to implement this kind of project is to start by sociocultural value and move from them, try to redefine and reshape representation of open or citizen science in different contexts. So I took more than 5 minutes, but that's the problem.
Thank you very much.
And now let's move over to the second circle and listen to Kalisa's story.
The Sandwatch project is a citizen science coastal monitoring project, but which includes an educational aspect as well, because we train teachers and educators on simplified scientific protocols to apply in school. So the project consists in a theoretical part, which can be studied in class, and then the practical part, which is applied in the nearby beach. Teachers take their student to the beach and they take a set of scientific measurements, trying to monitor the erosion, accretion, the quality of the seawater, the size of the sand, the state of the biodiversity, the coastal or the reef. They as well interview people using the beach. They interview the inhabitants of the beach to see what are the changes for the last 20 years or more. And then they go back to the school and do the assessment of their observation and collection of data. And then they identify the issues that are affecting the beach. And then they decide to take action and how to take action and who to contact to find solutions to these issues. We introduced the Sandwatch methodology in more than 50 countries worldwide. But it's an introduction. It doesn't mean they all implemented it. But at least 25 did implement it in schools and community groups. Sandwatch has many objectives, actually. One of the objectives is, to raise awareness of the youth, but as well at the community level about the climate change and the environment issues. But the other big objective is really that this data, because where we're working in small island developing states, we are working in other coastal countries as well. But in the case of SIDS, small island developing states, SIDS, they do have less human resources to record data. To monitor, they have not many scientists to do that. So we really need a community to do the rest and to help in this process. So we need as well this data to be used by the policymakers or by coastal planners when they are taking decisions or writing reports or for international processes. So this is a really an important aspect that this data is used. The other objective is to inspire scientific careers, because most of the time we see science as very difficult area, and we don't necessarily go to scientific careers. But when you monitor with a simple method, then you see that you can do it, and then with a bit of efforts, you can do even better or even more. We do have a database, Sandwatch database, since 2013. To be honest, this is a long process for the data to be complete, because many schools collect data, but they don't enter it systematically in the database. So we are training the schools and educators to enter this data more often. So, but we do a database, and we have a scientist, an ocean scientist who is looking at the entries and is more or less validating, but it's not, 100% validating scientifically rigorous data, like, because it's still citizen science, but very complementary to the scientific monitoring. So this is a quick summary of what is the Sandwatch project.
Okay, let's go over to Soledad for the final story.
In 2008, the first marine reserve in mainland Ecuador was created. And this was a result of a petition of the local community leaders that wanted to protect the marine resources of the area that were already overexploited and impaired. In Ecuador, there are only two marine reserves. One is the Galapagos Marine Reserve that you've for sure heard, and this, the Galera San Francisco Marine Reserve. At that time, I was working in an Ecuadorian NGO, Instituto Nazca Institute for Marine Research, and as marine ecologists, our role was to design, together with the local communities, conservation actions to evidence the benefits of managing a marine protected area and to involve the people in the management. We knew from the beginning that this was not going to be easy, because although they were very interested in recovering the resources that they depend upon, they are extremely poor. So a colleague of mine, Seco is his nickname. Seco in Spanish means dry. And that's his nickname because he's very, very thin. So Seco and me approached directly the lobster fishermen. And the lobster fishermen are the poorest fishermen among the fishermen of this area. And this is a little weird because lobsters have a very high commercial price. However, in this area, as in other parts of the globe, lobsters are overexploited. There are rules, like, for example, a minimum size, so people should wait until lobsters reproduce before extracting them. It's prohibited to take the females that are carrying eggs. And many times these rules are not known by the fishermen, by the communities, and also not by the consumers. Or some choose to ignore these rules. And in this area, this is very easy because the authorities that were supposed to control this were not doing their job. So we, with Seco, talked with the lobster fishermen, and we tried to have conversations to find out what to do, how to recover the lobster population and then maintain it so that in a while we can do sustainable and profitable fisheries. And the fishermen said, in a marine protected area, we want to do legal fishing, right, Sole? Like, yeah. Well, this will not be possible. If we start now applying the rules, we will not be able to take out one lobster because all of them are undersized. So the only option that we see is that we close the fishery, we stop fishing, until the lobsters recover. They were like, great idea. Can we do that? And they're like, no way. No, this is completely unrealistic unless we have another source of income. So we're like, okay. We invited and asked the lobster fishermen to invite all the lobster fishermen of the area to meet and start conversations, to think together, what can we do? What can we do? Yeah. And we had periodical meetings for around 3 months. And together with them, we wrote a proposal where the fishermen agreed and committed to create a no-take zone, to take care of this zone, and to monitor the progress of the lobsters. So we submitted this proposal. And after that, my colleague Seco and me were like, yeah, great. Seco, we wrote a proposal really together with the fishermen. And at the same time, we were like, we were terrified because it was not easy. Not easy to work with the fishermen. Most of the time, they would come to the meetings completely drunk, very dirty, smelling like fish. And it was very difficult to have conversations because they would not listen to each other. They would not agree easily on things. So we're like, okay, let's go. Let's do it. And amazingly, we had two positive responses. Conservation International, which is an international NGO, private NGO, agreed to fund a conservation agreement with the fishermen that covered the opportunity cost for them. So the cost or the money that they would stop getting because of stopping fishing. And Fauna and Flora International, another NGO, said, okay, we will support you for monitoring the lobsters. So we're like, yeah, great. We started meeting with the fishermen every week and first designed the monitoring methodology. And it ended up being a combination of fisheries methodology with scientific methodology. So they would go out to the sea, put the nets as they normally did, take out the lobsters. But now instead of staying with the lobsters, they had to measure them, weigh them, register the sex and put them back in the water. And part of the agreement was also to monitor the recruitment as to how many baby lobsters are coming to this protected area. There was no fisheries methodology for this, so we used the recommended scientific methodology, which did not work at all. And we tried different things and adapted it. Nothing. The fishermen said, you know what? Let us look for the baby lobsters. Let us try some things. They found the baby lobsters. They designed the methodology. And they were like, oh, we're scientists too. And this motivated them a lot. And by their own initiative, they said, we want to try an experiment to find better fishing gear. Fishing gear that is more selective, less destructive than the net that we are using. So they tried to make traps and cages for catching the lobsters. Nothing worked. They tried many things. Nothing worked. But this, at the moment, was not important at all. What was important was that they suddenly were having conversations. They were working as a team. They were free. They felt free to be curious and to try things and to fail and to try it again and to fail again and to just do it. And at that moment, they also felt the necessity to organize formally. So they created an association called Arte Langosta. I had a flag. So they created Alga Langosta. Huh? And they also asked for some training in finances, basic finances for everybody, and more in depth for the people that was more interested in this. And soon they started a common fund, and then they rented a place to make it as their base. And the place looked, I was going to say a little bit like this, not so elegant. It was an old house, but it was an open space where they had their gear, they had their posters, where they met every week. But they also offered this space to the community. So everybody, anybody in the community could come and celebrate their birthdays, marriages, funerals, everything. So the community started paying attention to these fishermen, started looking at them differently, some with respect, others with mistrust. How are these fishermen getting so much money? How? Why? So social conflict started in the community. And then we thought, okay, we need a training in conflict management for the fishermen. And they got it. And they also said, we need a communication program. We want to, and they did it, they organized this, and they went to the different schools, met with fishermen, with the communities, with authorities, and they told what they were doing. They explained to everybody their project, how were they measuring the lobsters, why. And this was great because then it was clearer for everybody what was happening there. And they got the attention of many people and authorities. At the same time, the monitoring continued, and they saw that the lobsters were growing and the abundances were increasing and increasing. So the fisheries authorities were like, wow, whatever these fishermen are doing is working. But they were not the only ones saying this, but also other fishermen from other areas or other fishermen that were not lobster fishermen. So people, whenever they had the opportunity, would come in this area and steal the lobsters, take them away. And when this happened, the fishermen said, okay, what we are doing is good, but it's not enough. If we want to be self-sufficient, we cannot depend only on the lobsters. To recover the lobsters will take some time. So they looked for an alternative fishery that they could do following responsible practices and all the rules. They also said, okay, if we're going to have legal fisheries in the reserve, we need to talk to the other fishermen, we need to show them the rules, and more than that, we need to find something to motivate them to follow the rules. And then they also said, well, we also need to educate the consumers. If tourists come and ask, are happy to eat whatever size of lobster, then fishermen will keep fishing whatever size of lobster. At this moment, they teamed up, and this was also great, with the Ministry of Environment, with different programs, different institutions, the Undersecretary of Fisheries, and they started making posters and information material to say, okay, these are the regulations, these are the fishing times, this is what you can do and you can't do. They made a loan to buy a boat. They had a new fishing gear. They started to fish, following all the regulations. And they looked to commercialize this fish directly to the restaurants in the main cities. So they avoided the intermediaries that pay much, much less and don't recognize the effort of fishing good. At this moment, they won a prize. The government offered a prize for communities that were doing local efforts for conservation. They won $30,000 that they used to build a warehouse with the vision of involving all the fishermen in the reserve to fish sustainably, to bring their fish there, and to cover the demand of these restaurants that were willing to pay more for a good fishery. In 2015, by the end of 2015, because of external forces, we were forced to leave the reserve. There was a lot of piracy, criminality, and narcotraffic. Arte Langosta dissolved. Very few fishermen stayed there. But some of them became park rangers in the marine reserve, and others kept studying, finished their houses. And many people say, oh, that's a sad ending. No. And it is, in a way. But it is also a happy ending in the way that these fishermen changed completely. At the end, they were coming to all the meetings completely sober, clean. They were there. They were working as a team. And then they thought in their community. Let's support the community. And then they thought in the area, in the zone, the marine reserve. They, as a benefit of this project, they received all this training that they will have forever and they can use in any activity they do. So yeah, that's the story.
We had about 50 to 60 participants at the Story Cafe. And for me, one of the most impressive experiences was that after listening and discussing in smaller circles for about 2 hours, people still were staying and agreed to share their thoughts and their questions afterwards with all the participants. So even though it was a very hot Sunday afternoon, the air in the ballroom was getting stickier and stickier, and also it took some time to set up the microphones, people stayed and listened to each other. And to me, that was a really powerful opening of this whole conference on citizen science. On the next day, the three speakers agreed to come together again to share some reflections.
Yesterday we had our Story Cafe, and what were your impressions? What came up in the discussions?
For me, it was an incredible experience because it gave us the opportunity to talk about our stories in a very relaxed environment, and everybody was happy and excited to learn from our stories. And the questions that came up were different as the questions that you have in a scientific environment. For me, it was something to take with me was the ask for publishing also this story and not only the scientific data that came from this project.
Mm-hmm. I agree as well. I have the same feeling, but I think the questions were very pertinent because, in the groups there were citizen scientists, but as well, I guess, researchers and people from academia and who were asking very targeted questions, which allowed me to develop further from what I said before. So it was interesting. I mean, this exchange, I guess they learned a lot, and I learned a lot from the exchange as well.
The session was very exciting for me because I was very happy to share a story from Africa, but I was impressed by the fact that people around me seems to learn a lot from our experience, and they seem to be aware that they have to take first the sociocultural values before implementing some project. And the most important thing for me is that they make like a projection, so they recognize that it's not only the case of Africa, it's the case everywhere. The situation we are discussing or we are dealing with in Africa should be taken consideration in many contexts, even inside Europe. So for me, it was a very good output to take this case from Africa and replicate it in a Western context, to learn from Africa and try to solve some problem in Western context.
And that was one of the central questions, I think, now that your cases are all not located in Europe. And that would be another question. What do you think, what can people who do citizen science in Europe learn from the experiences that you had or from the practices, from the social cultural backgrounds in which you were working? Are there things that should be taken into account here, or what people can learn?
I personally think that what Thomas said might be go to that point is that we live in so many different cultures, and each culture has their own understanding and concepts and way of living or investigating their environment, and this has to always be taken in account. I guess what not only Europe can learn from these examples, but we all should learn from everywhere, from each other, is to listen, to observe, to take in account the different ways of living and the different ways of expressing of people in different cultures.
Mm-hmm. I mean, implementing a citizen science in small island developing states, we encountered a lot of challenges, but as well opportunities to work with communities. And I realized that in Europe, actually, they are facing the same challenges. And especially in this area of coastline change and coastal monitoring. So, researchers, or even researchers, are facing the lack of data in some areas. Some areas are well monitored and others are not at all. And they are encouraging citizens to join their monitoring so that all the areas are taken into account. The other challenge is how to make the project sustainable so that it's owned by the community and citizens, and it runs by itself without your support. So this was one of the common challenge as well. And the experience with the Sandwich project in integrating the methodology into national curricula proved to be a good option. Even here, people were interested to learn more about this integration of the components into the national curricula.
Curricula is school.
School curricula, sorry. But it can be in a formal or informal school curricula. So it can be in the community educators who are integrating those components into their programs, environmental programs or guidelines, and as well in the national education curricula.
And I think from Soledad's story there, I also took a strong message forward for sustainability of projects in terms of the educational component of the work that you were doing with the fishermen At least that's what I got. That was a central moment for them to take over the project and to move it into new directions, and then even afterwards to go their own ways.
Exactly. Now through that, they became autonomous. They learned, and they are able to also spread this knowledge in their communities, and domino effect. Is there
something regarding that challenge of sustainability of projects that?
Sustainability in my mind and in my context is not only about financial sustainability. It's also cognitive sustainability. So in terms of mindset, that is why particularly my work is focused on kids, because by education I can shape their mindset. I can, as she said, I can give them or allow them to share or to keep and transmit our knowledge in a certain manner during generation. And for me, education is the most important, the basis of sustainability of citizen science.
Anything you want to add?
The conclusion for me in my session was just that, and what I learned with discussion with people is that the narrative around citizen science projects should be sensitive to sociocultural value in order to be impactful in the context. So that is the great lesson I learned with during the discussion with the other.
And yeah, and there should be a collaboration between different actors. Mm. I mean, the citizens, academia, and policymakers. This is because it should, at the end, serve as well the purpose of informing the policymakers, but as well going back to the community itself. So it should serve. It should be a cycle serving every actors involved in it.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening.